Tonight I'm going to talk about synchronicity. There's a synchronicity is, as some of you know, it's meaningful coincidences. Coincidences that things that are ostensibly coincidences that actually provide a lot of guidance in life. Before I even talk about this, the whole question, is there such a thing as synchronicity? It really leads immediately to what I would call two very different worldviews it's more nuanced than this, but just for simplicity, I'll say that there's two worldviews, what you could call a more scientific worldview and the worldview of the mystic. And the scientific worldview is the world is only what we see. And, any coincidence is just a coincidence. And if I happen to find it meaningful, then that's my own interpretation. But in this worldview, I may or may not find, books that are meaningful to me. I may not, whatever job I find or jobs I find may or may not be meaningful, whatever people I meet in my life, some of them will be better for me than others, but there'll be no rhyme or reason to it, really. That's a worldview that actually lends itself to a lot of meaninglessness. Now, by contrast, the mystic's worldview is one in which there's an inherent interconnection. And so it's easy to understand in this worldview why there would be synchronicity, because everything is kind of interconnected to begin with. And what's interesting just about thinking about these two views, the first one I called quote-unquote scientific, and that's sometimes how that worldview is described, the natural sciences themselves are not in the business of validating worldviews. The natural sciences themselves purely tell us the details of what happens in the physical world. All questions about worldview, about does God exist or is any religion true or not true? Science has nothing to say on any of those topics. And science, of course, science itself many times has made the very human mistake of assuming that the limits of what we can see or the limits of what we can observe are the limits of what is. Made that mistake innumerable times in the past few hundred years. And that's such a human mistake. Schopenhauer said, every person assumes that the limits of their vision is the limits of the world. And so there's certainly some things that are problematic about the scientific worldview, the quote-unquote scientific worldview. I'll also say that it's very interesting. One could have that very rigorous, logical, scientific view and not do any work on themselves. In other words, I could be a person who walks around in blame states all the time and bitter about the way other people are and why can't those people have a problem, that sort of thing. And it would be logically consistent with my worldview, the scientific worldview. Whereas the mystic's worldview, even taking that worldview, imposes a kind of responsibility on us, a responsibility to do our own spiritual work. And in fact, the more we do our own spiritual work, the more that worldview opens. And so it's a very interesting thing about the nature of these worldviews. So within the mystic's worldview, we'll take this for the moment. Synchronicity. We live in a world in which we are all connected. We're connected energetically to each other. We're deeply interconnected in so many ways. And so it's not surprising that there are moments when, say, the right book falls into my hands, or the right piece of music happens to be playing, you know, the moment I walk into the store, or I find the job that I where I belong, or I meet the people that I need to meet. Those are some of the bigger examples. But really, how can I say it? The world is dense with synchronicity. The more we pay attention to the world, the more we see it happening. You know, Carl Jung was really the man who created the term synchronicity, and wrote about it a little bit. And he said synchronicity is an ever-present reality for those who have eyes to see. And so it's very interesting, you know, one question is simply, how much are we paying attention to life? You know, how keenly are we paying attention? And I always think of it as one of the deep insights of Buddhism, that there's this profound connection between how much I can pay attention and how happy I am, you know? If I can't pay attention very much, that's going to place a limit on my happiness. The more I can pay attention, the happier I can be. And of course, one reason is the more I'm paying attention, the more attuned I am to, you might say, the magic of the world. Those subtle little things that when I'm paying attention, that's meaningful. But if I were wrapped up in my own story, I would miss it, you know. And so certainly one aspect of synchronicity is, are we just open? Are we here when life is happening? You know, that kind of thing. Another aspect that's important to consider with synchronicity is, synchronicity often has a message. How open am I to that message? You know? What happens if the message comes and it's a message I don't want to hear? You know? Do I still honor the synchronicity in that moment? Or do I find a way to say, that's not real. That's not something I'm going to accept. You know? And it's, as is often the case, it's quite likely that the message that I don't want to hear is probably the one that I most need to hear, you know? Much in the same way that the feedback that somebody gives me that I most want to reject, that might be the stuff I most need to listen to, you know? It's that paradox. It's something that is really showing me where I'm very deeply attached, where I'm very deeply defended. And so that's just an important inquiry, you know, not only with respect to synchronicity, but to feedback and to, you know, conversations with friends and life partners and everything else. You know, what is the message about myself, about my life, that I'm not willing to hear? And life in some ways is very compassionate. If there's a message I don't want to hear, it seems that life finds many, many different ways to send that message to me, you know, that sort of thing. Ultimately, I would say that synchronicity is a small part of what I would call a larger relational system. I think the way I would say it is that the sacred, in some ways, most calls upon our relational capacities, my capacity for vulnerability, my deep sensitivity, my tenderness, my capacity for humility, the kinds of qualities that are called in deep, intimate, personal relationships. You know, certainly the sacred has very little to do with the strategic mind, and I think a lot of people, you know, look for the sacred and don't find it because they're looking with their strategic mind. And it's a funny thing about, if we look at the scope of world religions, because of course the Western religions have these very fixed ideas about a personal God, and they'll even, you know, have, you know, these profound statements about our God as a personal God. In the East, you tend to get more impersonal gods, or these kind of, you know, grab bags, you know, like Hinduism, where there's a mix of personal gods and impersonal forces. And the advantage of having a personal god as one symbol for the sacred is that it almost automatically engages all the relational capacities, because I'm in relationship to something that's relating to me. But of course, the problem with symbolizing the sacred as a personal god is that I, you know, in practice, what often happens is people project all their unresolved parent issues onto the personal god, and then the personal god has all these unpleasant qualities, you know. But if we think of this relational connection to the sacred, synchronicity is, you might say, a very compassionate message, a very subtle but compassionate message. Part of the teaching might be how subtle it is, how deeply I have to be paying attention to the world to get the message. And part of the message might be the content of the message also. And the message is also often going to be a challenging one, you know. My years of being a teacher, I think, have really given me some insight in how the sacred operates, you know. Like, how can I say? At the beginning of the year, I'm covering chapter one, and that's what the kids are working on, chapter one. By later in the year, we're working on chapter four. At this point, they're experts at chapter one. They'd love it if I gave them more problems on chapter one. And, you know, every once in a while, they'll get a problem in review. But now chapter four, that's the hard stuff, and that's what we're working on, you know. And it's, I think, in much the same way, you know, there are lessons that we master and we're good at. Yeah, I'd like to have to deal with that. I know how to deal with that. And that's not what the sacred is giving us at this point. It's like, no, right now, the next hard thing you need to learn is this. Synchronicity is, you might say, it's an element of a magic quality of the world. And part of opening to it is simply trusting the magic. You might even say just allowing the magic, allowing the world to have its own magic. Ultimately, this magic is, I would say, akin to the magic that the Zen masters saw, you know, when they're just, you know, sweeping the ground or weighing flax or something like this, and it's the breakthrough experience of the Buddha in that very simple, tangible gesture. So I'll share the quote sheet. The lead quote is from the Tao Te Ching, this quote about the great symbol, which is essentially the Tao. She who holds the great symbol will attract all things to her. They flock to her. That actually should be they. That's a typo. They flock to her and receive no harm, for in her they find peace, security, and happiness. You might say that is the oldest statement of the idea, the modern idea that people like to call the law of attraction. And it's also just an old statement about the more we center in the deep truth, the more we hear, more we receive the truth of life in all forms, including in synchronicity. There's a quote from Walt Whitman. "To me, all the converging objects of the universe perpetually flow. All are written to me, and I must see what the writing means." Kind of figures that Papa Walt would have had this figured out long before Jung wrote about it. Then the Jung quote, which I already said. Then Shivananta Saraswati said, "At various points in our life, or on a quest, and for reasons that often remain obscure, we are driven to make decisions which prove with hindsight to be loaded with meaning." And that's funny. Sometimes we see synchronicity coming up. Sometimes we only discover synchronicity in retrospect when we look back and we think, oh, wow, that was really important that I took that path, you know? Dag Hammarskjöld, that amazing philosopher king, "To have humility is to experience reality, not in relation to ourselves, but in its sacred independence. To see it, judge, and act from the point of rest in ourselves. Then how much disappears, and all that remains falls into place. In the point of rest at the center of our being, we encounter a world where all things are at rest in the same way. Then a tree becomes a mystery, a cloud of revelation, each man a cosmos of whose riches we can only catch glimpses. The life of simplicity is simple, but it opens to us a book in which we can never get beyond the first syllable." Kushu Ukayama says, "Pure religion is the attitude of discovering the life within the self that is connected to all things. It means aiming at manifesting the life of each and every encounter and seeing all of these encounters as our own life." Marie-Louise von Franz, the Jungian who studied with Jung, said, "As soon as we begin to notice certain types of events like to cluster together at certain times, we begin to understand the attitude of the Chinese, whose theories of medicine, philosophy, and even building are based on a science of meaningful coincidences. The classic Chinese test did not ask what causes what, but rather what likes to occur with what." And it raises this fascinating question, you know, why is cause and effect so important to us? I mean, certainly there are things where there's cause and effect, and those are, you know, when we can use that, that's great, but why is that the only way to look at things, you know? Carlos Castaneda says, "All of us, whether or not we are warriors, have a cubic centimeter of chance that pops up in front of our eyes from time to time. The difference between an average man and a warrior is that the warrior is aware of this, and one of his tasks is to be alert, deliberately waiting, so that when that cubic centimeter pops up, he has the necessary speed, prowess to pick it up." Very demanding quote there. The Jungian Jean Shinoda Bolin, wonderful wise woman, says, "Synchronistic meetings are like mirrors that reflect something of ourselves. If we want to grow spiritually, all we have to do is take a good look. Synchronicity holds the promise that if we want to change inside, the patterns of our external life will change as well." David Rico says, "We do not create our destiny. We participate in its unfolding. Synchronicity works as the catalyst toward working out that destiny." Deepak Chopra says, "According to the Vedanta, there are only two symptoms of enlightenment, just two indications that transformation is taking place within you toward a higher consciousness. The first symptom is that you stop worrying. Things don't bother you anymore. You become lighthearted and full of joy. The second symptom is that you encounter more and more meaningful coincidences in your life, more and more synchronicities. This accelerates to the point where you actually experience the miraculous." Kabir Helminski says, "When we are aware of the abundance of life, synchronous events unfold in a continuum of time. Love brings together what we need to be brought together." Sumung Kid says, synchronicities, those times when outer events resonate mysteriously and powerfully with what's happening inside, are more numerous during great shifts and upheavals. When we pay attention, if we approach them as symbolic and revelatory, they will often illuminate a word for us. And I don't know if they're actually more numerous during great shifts and upheavals, or just if we're paying more attention during great shifts and upheavals. It's an interesting question. James Redfield said, as we blossom or awake, we begin to notice there is a force in the world that seems to be operating and leading us into a certain destiny. It's very much a kind of detective effort on our own part to figure out what these things mean. Synchronicity is essentially a meaningful coincidence that brings us information at just the right time. While leading us forward, it also feels very inspiring and destined in a way. It feels like we're on a path of unfolding in our own personal evolution. Mark Nepo said, whether through the patterns left in the snow, or the geese honking in the dark, or through the brilliant wet leaf that hits your face the moment you are questioning your worth, the quiet teachers are everywhere, pointing us to the unlived portions of our lives. I love that phrase, unlived portion of our lives. When we think we are in charge, the lessons dissolve as accidents or coincidences. But when we're humble enough to welcome the connections, the glass that breaks across the room is offering us a direction, giving us a clue to the story we are in. Anthony Horowitz says, everything in life has a pattern and a coincidence. And everything in life has a pattern, and coincidence is simply the moment when the pattern becomes briefly visible. And it's true, there are these deep, meaningful patterns throughout life that we slowly tap into. Steve Maraboli says, life is monotonous if you don't allow for synchronicity. Through the years, I've learned that chance encounters aren't random. There are beautiful people and moments that can change your life if you let them. Synchronicity is the font with which God writes.